Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Big Drink Rethink, where I am joined in the studio today by Lindsay Francis. Lindsay and I met through mutual contacts a short while ago, and she immediately struck me as someone I wanted to talk to on this show to bring her perspectives to you. And here's why. Lindsay works with people the world assumes have it most together. CEOs, investors, high-achieving leaders, people whose lives look from the outside like the destination that everyone else is working towards. She's a leadership psychologist, a clinical sophrologist, which she's going to explain to us, a behavior change specialist, and she spent over 20 years or so working at the very sharp end of human performance. She also hosts her own podcast, Rich Simple Human, which is well worth a listen to and which I have been on, which was a lovely experience. What makes Lindsay really interesting to me, and I think to you, is that she knows from the inside what it feels to be trapped by alcohol. She's a long-term AA member, so she carries something very rare, a view from both sides, the boardroom and the AA room. And what she has to say about those two worlds have in common might really surprise you. So this is an episode about the universality of the trap, about why the internal experience of being stuck, you know, the shame, the disconnection, the sense of not being quite worthy, looks almost identical, regardless of whether you're at the top of your game or whether you feel like you've lost it entirely, and about what actually moves it when it feels like nothing else can. So Lindsay, welcome to the show. I'm really, really looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna. And of course, we've got so much to talk about today.
Yeah, we have. But just to start off with, have I done you justice? Have I left anything out that you would like me to, or you could fill in by way of an intro?
Well, you did a wonderful job. Thank you. And yes, I'm a leadership legacy and wealth psychologist working at that really interesting intersection of success, performance and satisfaction, which of course means different things to different people, although we are all human. I suppose the one piece that you did mention that people may be thinking, what is she talking about, is the word sophrology. And for those of you that aren't based in Switzerland, Spain or France, sophrology is a method that was designed in the 1950s by a Spanish neuropsychiatrist in Madrid, who was very busy administering electric shock therapy to mentally ill patients. And he spent the rest of his life designing a method to alleviate this kind of human suffering that's now been used all over Europe and is actually available on prescription in many places to support performance, anxiety, health, well-being. Most of our sports teams in France and Switzerland have a sophrologist, as do our corporates and childbirth, etc. Alfonso Caicedo was the doctor who founded the method, and it's very, very popular and still thriving in many areas, but is yet to make it big in the English-speaking world. So I'm delighted to not only have operated my own clinic, but also be using that as the foundation of the work that I do.
Amazing. And it's yet to make it onto this podcast. So this is a first, and we will get into that, I'm sure. You know, what that brings to the work and the unique angle of what you do. But let's start, Lindsay, if we can, with an observation that really sits at the heart of this. You, as you have just said, you know, you occupy a very unusual position, really. You work inside one of the most high performance, high achievement worlds that there is. And at the same time, you've also spent a long, long time in AA and in AA rooms, which is about as far from that world in a way as you can get on the surface, at least. When you look across your client base and also, you know, the AA environment, the rooms that you've sat in there, what strikes you most about how similar the internal experience of being dependent, feeling dependent on alcohol is, regardless, therefore, of the outside circumstances.
Yeah, it's a great question, Anna, isn't it? And one that we see people lean out from, because, of course, a lot of people's reactions when you talk about alcohol and addiction is, I'm not as bad as X, Y, and Z. Mm. We do classic othering. Oh, I'm not as bad as them. Or people will often say, well, am I as bad as you were? You and I have had the same conversation. Well, how bad is it? I think to start with, if you're even asking yourself those questions, you must be experiencing some discomfort. So the internal experience must be telling you that this is not how, perhaps how things should be. I love the words optimal human flourishing. Harvard are very busy spending a lot of money and a lot of time researching what human flourishing actually is. And of course, human suffering is also an experience that cuts across demographics, social class, because human suffering is a human experience. Mm. Whether we're suffering in a pair of £1,000 handmade shoes or suffering in a pair of 99p flip-flops, the suffering will still feel the same on the inside. What we cover the outside in, what car we drive, if we drive a car at all, is irrelevant. Those feelings of a lack of security, a lack of significance, and a lack of acceptance cut across everything. Mm. We talk in work about, why am I using alcohol? Well, the reason that we're using alcohol is the same, irrespective of where we come from. We're using it to change the way we feel because we don't like what's currently going on. And those feelings are often the same. They are those feelings, as I said, of feeling unworthy, insecure, and insignificant. And they're the three I think I boil it down to most of the time.
Mm. No, I mean, I can totally relate to that. And I suppose if we can, you know, we can sort of say that those are the three elements of human suffering that, you know, we can all have in common, regardless of our circumstances. That feeling of being trapped, I think there's a universal feeling and a universal sort of set of emotions around that too. And the reason I raise that in this context, talking to someone who works with people who have potentially every resource at their fingertips, is that being isolated in that feeling of suffering can keep us trapped, regardless of what's in our bank accounts, I suppose, regardless of what we have access to. Is that something that you would also say is true?
Yes, I would. And I think what's interesting when we talk about the pressures of privilege, because that's essentially what we are talking about, people who are financially privileged or successful, the feelings of isolation are more dramatic than many people on the outside can imagine. When you are in that ultra high net worth bracket, unfortunately, you are normally the client. So people are often coming to you because you're a commodity, that you are valuable to them financially. That makes a feeling of isolation even more dramatic sometimes. And I don't know if people can wrap their heads around that easily, but it's something people often challenge me on. They may say, Lindsay, you spend most of your podcast talking about money or wealth. And what about people that haven't got it? Well, absolutely, we have two sides to the coin here. And we don't have a shortage of money in the world. We have a shortage of distribution. Mm. So we know it's not evenly distributed, but we know people are suffering throughout the entire spectrum of wealth and success.
I think it's easy. I think it's possibly too easy to sort of sit at the outside, on the outside, and look at someone who is very wealthy or very successful, and is certainly on the outside living a very aspirational life, and sort of think, what have you got to be unhappy about? And I am sure, therefore, if you flip that over to the individual who is suffering, they can also think, nobody would understand. Nobody would understand what's going on with me. No one would have much sympathy, maybe, for what's going on with me. So the sort of the external evidence, if you like, of a good life can become its own sort of prison, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it becomes a cage. Mm. And I think that concept of successful on the outside but failing on the inside is something that people will listen to and say, yes, that's me. On the outside, it looks like I've got everything going for me. And on the inside, I'm failing miserably. My relationships are falling apart. My sense of worthiness and self is nowhere to be seen. I'm only as good as the car I'm driving. That's not human flourishing. No matter how much money you've got, you must recognize that that's a time to go away and think, where can I get some help to build a toolkit to get myself out of this? Because that's not fun to live like that. No. And it also means that you're not very effective in the world. So I think for me, my motivation for working at this level, Anna, is a lot of these people are in very senior leadership positions. They're leading big families. They might be very effective in their family office. But if they're not flourishing optimally, it casts a shadow to everybody that's beneath them. And a rising tide lifts all ships. So when we can redirect that sense of self and people can really flourish optimally in those much more, let's call them successful positions, the impact can be and is, as we've seen, absolutely huge.
You raise a really important point there, because quite often, if you're a very, very senior leader, and let's just take the classic CEO title, if you are in that position, then you are potentially your top of the tree. And there are a couple of things that strike me there. First of all, it's lonely at the top. It can feel very, very lonely. You are certainly expected to have it all together. There is potentially even if maybe not having it all together is the right word, you wouldn't necessarily show vulnerability. You wouldn't necessarily show weakness. You certainly wouldn't stand up in front of investors and various other sort of interested parties and say, you know what, I'm falling apart here. So that brings its own sort of performative aspect. And I think the other thing that really strikes me is picking up on what you just said, that, you know, the sort of the metaphor about the ship. You are responsible for a culture. In those kind of big leadership positions, you are responsible for the culture within the organization that permeates all the way down. You are the sort of the role model, if you like. So again, that brings with it a certain amount of pressure to not necessarily reveal all the intricacies of what's going on inside. It's a particular kind of lonely. It's an isolation that must feel very, very painful.
Absolutely. And I think also, in order to have got to that level where you're the CEO or the founder, you've had to work extremely hard. You've had to find some coping mechanisms. And if alcohol has been one of them, then you've probably got a load of others as well. You've pushed, you've been through the grind to get there. So your level of self-awareness and sensitivity has had to be dulled down so you can endure the pain. It's a bit like endurance athletes, Anna. You know, they don't run along and think, oh, I'm worrying about that blister. They run along and think, oh, there's a blister. I will now ignore that for the next 10, 15, 20 hours of my ultra marathon or whatever it is. And our high achievers work in the same way. So when we do start to strip back those layers, it's a deeply unpleasant experience because they're used to not feeling it. Of course, as we get older, this becomes a much, much bigger problem because our nervous system is just stacking that pain and that discomfort into our bodies. And then, of course, it comes out. So yeah, it's a super interesting area to talk about. And you're right, that vulnerability isn't very popular. And this is why the biometric data is so interesting. We've suggested if you're a chief executive with a low heart rate variability, i.e. a nervous system that's locked in fight or flight, are you even employable or investable? I can't tell you that's a very popular conversation.
No, I bet. But I think you will have heard this 100 times, I'm sure, as have I. But for many people, the definition of addiction is isolation, is disconnection. So I know this is a difficult sort of chicken and egg question, but what do you sense often comes first, Lindsay? Do you think it's the alcohol in these environments that can cause the disconnection? Or do you think it's a symptom of it? Because I guess what I'm saying is alcohol does often sit underneath a big sort of high performance environment. It's so normalized, you know, the client dinners and the business travel and the hospitality and the winding down at the end of the day and the rewards after a long week. It's completely woven into the fabric of it. And I suppose that chicken and egg question is where it sits, isn't it? It's, are we drinking because of a feeling of disconnection, or is it the drinking that's causing us to disconnect in those sort of environments?
Super challenging question. And of course, the myth of alcohol is that this alcohol is going to make me feel more significant, more secure, and more accepted. So I think that the belief is that I will be more connected because I will feel vibrant, I will feel alive, I will feel connected to this community, I will be part of the crowd. we're looking for a high, we're looking for a sense of excitement, or perhaps if we're shy or introverted, we're looking for the ability to connect with others through alcohol because it makes us feel better. The lie, of course, long term is that it does exactly the opposite. And I think people who perhaps just have one or two glasses might say, actually, Anna and Lindsay, my glass of wine does make me feel more connected. It makes me feel more alive. It makes me feel more relaxed. It's a social lubricant. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. But there is a tipping point. So in terms of chicken and egg, I think it's more of a tipping point where it becomes the thing we use to connect, but is actually the thing that eventually disconnects us, both from ourself, because you can't feel anything, and eventually from other people as that addiction accelerates over time. And time is an interesting word. You and I talked about it before, because time is so subjective in this field.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, it utterly, how one body, how one brain responds to alcohol is very, very different from another. I mean, we know certainly in this world of sort of neurodiversity and greater understanding of how alcohol hits people differently, that time can be very, very condensed indeed. And for other people, it can be a sort of 20, 30 year slide, almost imperceivable. Okay, so just a quick question for you then. I know this is going to require you to do a sort of very generalist answer, but when you think back over all the people that you've coached in this space, what would the two or three things be that they are most, I'm going to use the phrase thirsty for when they are reaching for a drink? If we're accepting that drink is filling a gap or helping them do a job, what would the top two to three jobs be that they are giving alcohol?
What are you thirsty for? I love the way you use that a lot, actually, in your work, Anna, because I think it's a really good question to keep asking ourselves. What do I think people are most thirsty for when they're drinking? I'm going to start with purpose. I think a lot of people wake up in the morning and think, this is really painful. What's the point? And this is, of course, where we can begin to edge into this sort of suicidal ideation. Why am I here? Why am I on earth? What am I actually doing? I think when we have a drink, it allows us to feel like we've turned that noise off a little bit, or it allows us to feel like, oh, I feel a bit better. I'd stop thinking about that. So I think I'm thirsty for purpose. What's the point of my life? Why do I exist? And especially in affluent spaces, I look around and I have everything. You know, I have everything that money could buy, and I want for nothing. And I often say to people, we've been fortunate to have more than we ever dreamt of, and it's more than enough. And you've heard that. Anna, you and I have something a lot of people never have. What is that? Enough.
And I guess the other thing about not just being able to look around and sort of see great affluence and think, why isn't this enough? But also maybe you have spent 10, 15, 20 years literally pouring your energy and all of your resources into building something that just doesn't feel enough. Building something perhaps not purpose-led, not mission-led, not truly aligned to who or what you are. Maybe it's a family business that you've just segued into. Maybe it's, a career choice that you took at 18 before you really knew what a career choice was. And it's just gone on and on and on and on and on. And then 20 years later, you're like, what the fuck's the point of all of this?
Yeah.
What is this? And is this me? And is this who I ever wanted to be? I suppose that's also I'm going to say sobering thought, but I suppose it's uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable thought that, as you say, you either want to kick down the road or just stop.
Yeah, it is an uncomfortable thought. And I think the key here to sophrology and the work that I do, and also a 12-step model and the method that you use, is there is a method you can follow to get to the bottom of this. It's this self-awareness and consciousness piece where we could say, okay, what am I using this for? What is this feeling I'm looking for? Why am I not getting it? Where else might I get it from? Because we know in a 12-step program, a simple daily gratitude and resentments practice changes everything. And I do it myself. Why am I in this striving, driving? I'm a hugely ambitious and very, very motivated individual. And that's not going away as I get older. In fact, it's almost becoming more exciting as the world changes and I see more opportunities, especially great wealth transfer is coming. We've got AI. There's a lot to get excited about. Why am I driving myself so hard today? And I can step back and say, actually, I've already got enough. Mm. Anything else now is a bonus. I'm grateful for the breath in my lungs, the beating heart in my body, the sun that came out again today, and the fact that I've got cold water on tap. Mm. Because a lot of the world doesn't have that back to basics. We've slightly segued off that question, what am I thirsty for? But I think it's we've missed the gratitude. We've missed the blessings that we've already got. We've missed what's already in our hands. And you know that in your own work, Anna. Mm. People forget, you know, I'm already blessed with a home, a family, a relationship maybe, or a job, or whatever it is. Let's really dial into those small gratitude practices. And I hate using those words because it's been so overused. But actually look around us. There's always going to be somebody with more than you. Look at Elon Musk.
Yeah.
You know, wherever we go, there's always somebody with more. And comparison is the thief of joy every time.
Absolutely. So in a way, I think, you know, just to recap, you're saying purpose for sure, but also just simple joy. It's almost as if the identity has been caught up into a sort of performative culture, and access to those small things, almost I'd say the real things, the down to earth things, eludes us slightly when you're always on in that culture. Is that fair in terms of what you've just said?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've built a world that's moving so fast. You know, we are totally hooked into those dopamine hits, and dopamine and pleasure are two totally different things. Why am I using alcohol? Well, I want to feel something, and I don't want to wait. I don't want to work for it. I just want it now, like my Amazon in the hour or whatever it is. I want it now. Wine or drugs are the quickest way, alcohol, to get this, pornography, whatever. If we wait and we go for that slow dopamine, it's far more fulfilling. It lasts a lot longer. You and I talked about that last week when we were chatting, that hedonistic adaptation. You know, we've geared up a world that is moving so quickly and it's delivering so fast. Why do you think Taylor Swift is obsessed with sourdough? Because it's slow. It's slow. I mean, anybody that does sourdough, I mean, it takes so long, it's ridiculous.
But isn't it?
Of course it is.
Yeah, it is, totally. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because the paradox is that in this very, very fast-paced world, the reach, the sort of the relief that people are looking for, the thing that they're turning to alcohol for, that the job they're giving it, is potentially to slow down. Whereas that's quite counter to the culture that they actually occupy in. And some people could say, but if you've made your millions and you've stacked up your wealth and you've got more than you ever need, why don't you just slow down? Why don't you just slow down? Why don't you stop? Why don't you retire when you're 40? Why do you always feel there's another corporation to build or another, you know, piece of real estate to buy or whatever it might be? So I suppose that's where the inability to stop, if you've occupied that world for so long, it's just, I guess what I'm saying in a way, sorry, I will get to a question in the end, I'm just doing a bit of a rambling. I guess in a way, you mentioned something a moment ago, it's easier to change our state than it is our lives. But some people would argue that when you have great wealth, you can change your life. You're in a privileged situation where you could just stop. Is that fair?
Oh, that question will be grinding in every listener's soul, I think. Have you ever tried that with a client? Said, you don't need the money, so why are you bothering? It's probably the most offensive thing you can say to somebody.
Have you tried that?
Of course. Yeah. I'm allowed to have a big pokey stick when I'm in a relationship with a client. And we do have those moments where we say, just explain to you why you're doing this again.
But this is true, isn't it? This is it, literally from the outside. You can sit there and you, possibly a little bit sort of in a very oversimplified way, you could say your lifestyle is killing you, mm-hmm. or your lifestyle is leading you to turn to choices that are not healthy and that are going to be very limiting in certain ways. They're not making you happy. Why are you doing this? What part of this feels like a good idea anymore? I suppose that's where people look at you and go, what?
Well, what are we talking about? I think a lot of people will give you great, you know, I work with extremely clever people, which is wonderful, which does mean I have to be on my A game. Thank goodness I don't drink anymore, because I can assure you in my sessions, my brain is working so fast. You know, I prep, plan. The way that sophrology works is it's a method that unfolds over a number of months, if not years. And, you know, I go in prepared and I'm prepared for the difficult questions. People will always come back with an answer. Well, I have to because there's an expectation, there's a responsibility. I'm responsible for other people. I'm serving, I'm building, I'm creating wealth. I understand all of that and those are true. But you do not need to be pushing in the way you are pushing. Mm-hmm. And that's not just at the ultra high net worth level. But we push because we don't want to feel anything. We move quickly because we get addicted to the speed. And let me just tell you, if you're moving at 100 miles an hour, you cannot A, smell the roses, or B, turn the corner safely. So you've just set a trajectory that is going to be going faster and faster and faster. And the world, of course, wants your money. It wants you to make more, spend more, do more. That's the way we've designed our consumer society. But we don't have, that's a choice. How do you get off? Well, you have to have a toolkit to be able to back off without your thinking suddenly, well, now what do I do with myself? And it's why retirement's so complicated, Anna, when you talk to people who are in that space and you say, what are your retirement plans? And they say, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, don't plan to retire.
I don't plan to retire. Or is that because you can't think of anything else to do? Well, it sounds boring. And that's where sophrology is beautiful because there's a lot of visualization involved. Let's visualize what that looks like at 95. Mm. Oh, where were you? Where did you go? Who were you with? What country might you have been in? What was the weather like? And then we begin to develop an appetite for the unknown. Because we don't have an appetite for the unknown, of course. We're creatures, we're tribal beings, and we're designed to be picked off by the wolves that are roaming around. We live in fear, which is why we get locked into this, you know, predicting fear, subconscious, what could kill me or eat me. We don't imagine this amazing day when we get to, you know, I don't know, go to heaven, live in eternity, whatever it is. We're not really designed to do that. But when we do that piece of work, okay, what does 70 look like? What might 75 look like? Okay, how do we build a life that gets you there? You can change direction. But if you haven't to change to, and you know this in our minds, the neural pathways, you can't stop a thought. You can only redirect a thought. So we don't stop, we swap.
Interesting.
And this is a powerful method.
I love that. And I suppose what's so much of this is around the identity, isn't it? Because for a lot of people in that world, they've subconsciously, albeit constructed an identity and maintained an identity that fits into that world. And imagining, you know, it's the same way as we struggle with identity change when we stop drinking. It's who am I when I'm not a drinker? I've known myself all my life as a drinker. It's exactly the same for someone who's known themselves all their lives as a high achiever. Known themselves all their lives as the person who builds and creates and runs and leads and makes a lot of money. Who am I if I'm not that person? It's the same resistance. It's the same stepping into something new that just brings up huge resistance and fear.
Absolutely. Who am I? Because actually, I want to feel secure, significant, and accepted. So who am I without this shell of the identity that I've created? Who might I be? Well, let's imagine that we take all that away and we replace it with something else. Who could you be? And my job is to do that in a safe way and in a way that's suitable for high achieving men quite often who, you know, they're not good at imagining or telling bedtime stories or making up, you know, Billy and the cat or whatever it is, narrative that we're having. But when we begin to think, actually, who could I be and what would that look like and can I play with those ideas? Then we begin to get this fresh appetite for change. And step away from where we are. But who am I without all these things? Well, then you'll just be you. Well, who am I? Well, in my opinion, you're whoever God created you to be. Well, who was that? Well, we need to slow down and ask those questions. How will I know? Well, what gifts and talents have you got? What are you good at that other people aren't good at? What capacities and capabilities do you have? What values do you have? And values and capacities is a very, very big piece of work that sophrology does. It's been doing that for a long, long time. When we can begin to see who we are, then we can plan to be who we really are meant to be and then what we're meant to be doing on earth.
You said something really interesting a moment ago. I mean, all of this is totally fascinating. I'm lapping it up. But you said something really interesting a moment ago about, you know, the pace and, you know, running at 100 miles an hour and all that sort of stuff. Underneath all of this is obviously, you know, physiologically, the nervous system is doing something. And you keep saying, you know, it's your role to create a safe environment to ask those questions. So what does a nervous system on high alert actually feel like from the inside? I mean, how, you know, do your clients even recognize that this is how they're sort of hitting life, how they're coming at life with a nervous system that is high alert all the time?
That's a great question. And you know, this is one of my favorite topics because I fit all my clients with a Whoop band. Many are already using Aura or looking at their Garmin stats. When we look at heart rate variability, we can see the gaps between the heartbeats that tells us whether we are in fight or flight or rest and digest and how flexible we are between the two. A low HRV, so not heart rate, not HR or resting heart rate, but HRV, heart rate variability, tells us that we're spending an awful lot of time stuck in fight or flight. We're in that one state. What does it feel like? Well, it will feel like a dry mouth, a racing heart, possibly more rapid breathing. You might be really slightly more frozen in terms of your eyes are slightly more open. You're not able to relax your gaze. You might have tension in your forehead. Your body is in a state of bracing. Very often we see people with large amounts of fat accumulating around their middle, this middle-age spread that we get that's, of course, historically or evolutionary designed to give us a fat store because we can't go out and hunt anymore and we're waiting to be fed. Mm-hmm. We have that fat store. Well, we might have this fat store because our body's thinking we need to be ready and available to fight, so we need to have some calories available quite quickly. We see that gut problems occur because the body isn't able to rest. Digestion is compromised. We also see sexual function being compromised. Blood flow to the area of the genitals is very compromised if you're in fight or flight all the time. And that normally gets the men going because, of course, we don't want to talk about it directly. But they may be saying, yes, I'm struggling in that area a little bit. It's simply the mechanics of your body. The blood can't flow down to those sensitive erogenous zones if your body is using the blood to run away from what it thinks is a wolf. It's very obvious. It's very basic science. Yeah. It's basically human design. So the question, Anna, of course, is in a world that's designed to have more data flying at us than ever before, how do we use those knobs and levers to turn the nervous system down?
Mm. So the Whoop or the Aura band or the ring which you're using is a revelation, I imagine. I imagine you have clients, you know, the world over going, bugger me, I didn't know that's what was going on. You look as though you're about to say something.
What they normally say, because they're very, very ambitious and nobody ever tells them what to do normally because they are at the most senior level of their organisation or they own the organisation or organisations, is they say, they'll show me their data. And this is also fun when it's pre-clients. And I'll say, oh, do you want to show me your data? I see you're wearing a Whoop band. They say, yeah, look at my resting heart rate. It's super low. I'm an athlete. I'm training for an Ironman. Look at my sleep. Isn't it amazing? And I say, oh, look at your HRV. It's about 12. Your nervous system is shot. No, it's not. Oh, really? Let's look at the data. And then, of course, I pull my own data out. Do you want to see mine? Oh, do you want to see some of my other clients anonymously? Mm. And they say, oh. They want to debate the data first, Anna, which I love, because if they've already paid at that point, of course, there's a conversation about you've come to see me for some reason. Mm. You clearly might know something that you don't, otherwise you wouldn't be paying me. Let's talk about what you thought that might be. Oh, well, and it's normally on referral. Somebody told me. Yes. Okay. So do you think this data? I think the data's wrong. Okay, I think the amount of money behind this tells us it's not.
Do you think this is because the nervous system is so little understood? Because part of me is thinking, you know, you're possibly showing people or explaining data to people, revealing something about them that they hadn't seen in themselves or they won't admit. Do you think that this is largely and often a sense of denial, or do you think it's often a sense of, oh, I wasn't looking at that metric. I was looking at that metric. Where does that sort of understanding normally sit?
I think it's a 50-50 conversation. First of all, this can't possibly be that bad. I don't feel that bad. I'm not that bad. I'm not on the street drinking out of a brown bottle, you know, the conversation. I'm not at rock bottom. Well, everybody's rock bottom is different. And if you can have a quicker rock bottom than anybody else and get sober quicker, I'd suggest you do that. Well, where was your rock bottom? This is sick. Comparison is the thief of joy. Don't go there. Look at the data and know it could be better. Give me 6 weeks. I'm going to show you. I think there is some subjective conversations. There's some defensiveness, of course. There's also a little bit of unbelief, Anna, because this data is not new. And if you start looking at teenagers, you start looking at the data and the peer-reviewed scientific research around low HRV and anxiety in teens, you will see that this is one of the most powerful diagnostic tools we have ever had available to mankind. But the problem here is there is no medication behind it. I cannot give you a pill to increase your heart rate variability. Your heart rate variability increases because you eat, sleep, breathe, move, pray, and meditate every day. And that's not a very appealing thing to somebody who's busy, time poor, and actually has got to learn a new technique to do that. And they have to do it every day for the rest of their lives.
And has always found a solution to everything, or gets people to find them a solution to everything. And this is one of those things for which there is no quick fix per se, no healthy, sustainable, long-term quick fix.
You have now got hundreds of biohackers listening, Anna, disagreeing with me. So if you are one of those, please write in, because I'd love to have that debate. But of course, people will say, well, we can just biohack our way out of that. We can have an NAD injection. We can go in the hyperbaric oxygen chamber. We can put on these various vagus nerve devices. We can do it that way. You can, but I think the old saying, you can't polish a turd, applies here. You do need to get to the root cause. You can't build on sand. It simply doesn't work. You can't biohack your way out of rubbish sleep and a diet that consists of cocaine, champagne, and takeaways.
So what shifts? What shifts when it stops being a feeling and starts being a fact? When you actually have these conversations with people and say, look, this is the data. And presumably you can also say, go off and have a drink tonight and have a look at the data. Now go and have no drinks tonight and look at the data. So, you know, evidence-based impact of what just one or two drinks might be doing to their system as a whole. What really shifts when they kind of go, oh, Christ, I can't actually deny that anymore?
Well, some people walk away, Anna. You walk away and say, I'm simply not going to look at the data.
Bollocks to this. I hate it. I don't want to do this anymore.
Exactly. We've got some very, very large corporate organizations globally who fitted their senior leadership teams with wearable trackers. And EY went public and fitted their entire senior management team with these data trackers. And then everyone just ignores the data. You know, they don't want to look at it. We don't want to see it. And actually, you know, we've got all of the GDPR around actually doing that as a corporate. People just ignore it. Oh, well, you know, I know you told me my data was terrible, but I don't feel that bad. I say, you don't. Do you want to go and get a CRP inflammation marker check as well? Because I'll put money on it that if your HRV is low, your inflammation is also high, and you are at high, high risk of inflammatory diseases, arthritis, cardiac problems. Is that not enough? I'd like to do something about this. But you and I have this conversation in our daily work all the time.
What are people defending? What are people protecting most fiercely, do you think, when they walk away and go, oh, bollocks to this, Lindsay, I don't want to work with you anymore, don't like the results, you know, don't like what you're telling me about my data. What do you think people are protecting most fiercely there?
Just their ego. And if you've built a life that really is around ego, how you look, where you go and what you do, then if you take all that away because you change it, what have you got left? Who are you? Who is that person underneath? And if you have no connection to a higher power and you genuinely think you are the most important or powerful thing in the world and there is nothing greater than you, where else have you got to go with that?
It really strikes me as we're talking that to go full circle back to the beginning of this conversation, you may well be talking about a very high net worth individual here, but all of these doubts, all of these fears, all of this resistance exists regardless of whether you are, you know, a hedge fund manager or you cut hedges for a living. You know, if you want to sort of really pull that apart, all these questions of the who am I and, you know, what does life look like going forward and, you know, what's my purpose and all the resistance that comes. I guess it's relative, isn't it? But it comes back to the universal suffering, the universal trap, and the sort of the protection that we put around ourselves for change. But what you do is in the high pressure chamber of high performance, high achieving, high net worth individuals. But it just goes to demonstrate, because you're saying certain conversations that you're having with your very high net worth clients, and I'm saying I'm having very similar conversations with my not so high net worth clients.
It's the same conversation every time. But the one thing I would say is people who are still doing work that involves some kind of physical connection, you mentioned hedge cutting. When we are using our bodies physically to achieve something every day, I believe there is more of a sense of satisfaction there because we're designed to be creative.
Right.
So pretending you're being creative because you're sitting in front of a computer is great. But actually, if you've just trimmed a hedge, mown a lawn, planted a bed of roses, made a sourdough, I do think there's some alleviation in human suffering by using the creative gifts that we've got. So I think that is quite an interesting conversation, perhaps one for another time, where people are sometimes, you know, I've had a hard day of physical labor. I've gone to the pub and really enjoyed a pint. I think it's a very different experience from somebody who's perhaps sat in front of the computer and then just goes out and has, I don't know, a cocktail. I agree, the human condition, you know, it's universal because we're all human. And do you want the thing, you know, to remind our listeners of the thing that really does cut across every sector is the fact that we will all die. We are all dying and we will all be dead. So what is the point?
And on that note, I'm not leaving this podcast there. It's possibly the worst place to finish a podcast.
Sorry about that.
No, but it's true. It's true, isn't it? It is. It's the most grounding and sobering of thoughts.
So true.
Yeah. So, and this, of course, I'm laughing when you say that, but it's so true that what you're really throwing into the mix there is a massive dose of perspective.
Absolutely. You will all be dead. If you're a heavy drinker or drug user and you're not already, congratulate yourself that you've got another day to try and rectify the situation. Every breath in your lungs is a point to be grateful. Because it's given.
I love that. Lindsay, when change happens, when something shifts for your clients, and I mean truly shifts, something that actually, you know, moves their view on this, not just helps or manages a good patch, but actually genuinely changes, how does that feel like in the nervous system if you've been running around on high alert for the best part of 30 years, building an empire, building corporations, working at an extremely, you know, high alert nervous system state? What does that genuine change feel like when you see those statistics change through the wearable technology? What does it actually translate to in the body as a feeling?
People always say, I just feel so much better. And then they always say, I didn't realize how bad I felt. And that's not very expressive, but they're the sort of bald terms that people use. You also see a massive change in behavior in terms of priorities around eating, sleeping, breathing, moving, and meditating. They become non-negotiables. You see people building international business trips around the process that they're using. You see people saying, well, when I get into New York, I found an ice bath and I've booked my time for meditation and I've done this and I've done that. They begin to structure their routine around the pillars that they know help them perform optimally. And that changes absolutely everything. In terms of the nervous system, you're basically just turning down the noise. You know, that ability. People will always say, I can't think clearly. Mental brain fog. I'm struggling with my hormones. All of those feelings go away because you develop a sense of calm, clarity, and serenity. And the problem, of course, is that serenity energetically is very close to the feeling of boredom. And I feel clients get close to peace and serenity and say, I'm bored. And I say, no, you're not. You're going in the right direction. I'm bored. I can't tolerate the boredom. I don't want to do this anymore. And when you look at this frequency of energy, you see that those emotions are almost exactly the same. It's like excitement and fear energetically close together. So I think that feeling of serenity is just another level.
So you're doing an awful lot. And I love that, by the way, because I often use that sort of fear, excitement, how it feels, you know, similar in the body, and it's your interpretation of it that can change. But I've not heard that sort of boredom versus peace, serenity comparison before. That's fascinating, because it's that it often comes up. I mean, I get that. I can really relate to that. So in effect, I certainly don't want to oversimplify what you do, because I want you to tell us how these things all come together. You've got your sophrology, which you've mentioned earlier in our conversation, helps you to visualize a future and a different way of being, and helps an awful lot with potentially the identity piece and a vision of the future, something to pull you forward towards a future and overcome the fear. And at the same time, you've got an awful lot of tools. That's probably even an oversimplification using that word, but processes, tools, scaffolding, structure that you can help put into people's lives to regulate the nervous system ongoing. Yeah, so it is. It's exactly that sense of you are designing what a life that keeps your nervous system calm, despite the fact that you have a high-powered job and you're flying between here and New York. You are going to find that ice bath when you get there. That's the yin and the yang of the job that you do and the things that you need to do to find that level of balance, yeah?
Yeah, and it's the mindset piece. So the sophrology part is visualization, breathing, body movement, and meditation to activate a level of consciousness that has a toolkit attached to it. So there are tools that we are using all the time. Sunshine breathing, the bubble visualization. So we might be going to the ice bath, but we're going to do something when we get there. We're not just going to go into the ice bath and think, I really hate my business partner or my investors are driving me crazy. We're going to take ourselves away from that and use these things in synchronicity to really elevate the results.
And to bring this back to a conversation for the masses, obviously not everybody has access to the sound baths, yeah, the ice baths, you know, the places that they can book into in their lovely, lovely hotel, sort of New York hotel rooms and stuff. There are some very basic and accessible ways of calming the nervous system for people who don't necessarily have the resources and the access to those kind of things as well, aren't there? So, I mean, you've mentioned the breathing, you've mentioned the meditation, you've mentioned journaling and mindfulness and just slowing down and allowing boredom. Those are all things which we can all do, regardless of resources.
The sophrology method was designed to work in groups in a hospital setting, much like Pilates. There are many books and a few English books around the sophrology method. It's a method you can teach yourself if you deployed it every day and tracked the results on a biometric data wearable. You would see incredible changes. And it's as simple as square breathing for 5 minutes a day. Can you tolerate that? That's 5 minutes. Many people say, I can't sit still for 5 minutes. Okay, try a minute, then keep working your way up. It is simple, but it's not easy.
A massively important distinction. Although I have literally just written a Substack post on choosing your hard as well. You know, that notion of it might be simple, but it's not easy. It's like, yeah, well, neither is running around with a nervous system on high alert or drinking too much and coping with the day after. You know, that's also not easy. So choose which one in a kind of brutal way. Quick question for you, because I'm conscious of time. It sounds like you would highly recommend people who aren't aware of sophrology and what it's about and how it can be built into everyday lives to go and have a look at it. Google it is the obvious place to start these days, but you mentioned books and stuff. I'm going to ask you a personal question for a moment. When you were doing your own work around your drinking and you didn't know about sophrology at the time, so what did that look like for you? What was the one thing that finally moved for you? I know you're an AA gal. Was it going to that community and staying in that community long term, or did you begin to layer on a lot of other practices too?
That's a great question. I think the biggest motivator or the biggest surprise for me was how much you can actually feel when you stop numbing yourself. Mm-hmm. And I remember standing in my kitchen thinking, what on earth is this emotion that's overcoming me? And it was anger. And I'd never really felt it that deeply before, because I probably would have numbed it or suppressed it and then drunk on top of it. when you are beginning to feel the range of being human, it's absolutely terrifying. So that in itself, I think, without going outside, just internally, that recognition of, you know, we're bright people. Wow, what's going on here? What is this? Okay, wow, this is deeply unpleasant. But then, of course, being able to go into a group and discuss that, listening to other people's stories, reading some of the amazing books that are out there about blackout drinking in particular. I didn't even know that that was a thing. I didn't even know I had that problem. I thought that was normal. I thought everybody drank to blackout. And when I realized, you know, after many, many years, is that not normal? Mm. And I say to my own children now, you know, this is not normal. The fact that you have no idea what you're doing, and for anybody who doesn't know, blackout drinking is when you can't remember anything at all, but you're still fully functioning. You can drive a car, you can cook a meal, you can do some extraordinary things, but you have no recollection because your body chooses, well, we can either keep the brain running or the body running. So we'll turn the brain off, in the most simplest ways, but the body will maintain, we haven't passed out, the body is still going, but the brain has got no memory at all. It's absolutely terrifying. If you drink like that, you're not metabolizing alcohol like normal people. Not that that's even a thing. Mm. So I think understanding other people's experiences for me was really transformational in a space of no judgment.
And therein lies obviously the beauty of AA, in the sense that it does bring that community together. And if the notion of addiction can be described as isolation and disconnection, then obviously what AA seeks to do is to connect you at that fundamental level and make sure that you realize it's not just you. And I know that there's lots of different perspectives on, you know, AA versus other routes and stuff, but it's still, you know, it still remains the original challenge, as it were, to the isolated thinking that it's just you. And that obviously is a hugely valuable insight to get when you realize it's not just me. In fact, it's people in every single walk of life. It's hugely powerful. And it's obviously the route that you went down. Quick question for you. Last question for you. When you have worked with clients at a very, very senior level, would you say to them, for maintenance and for ongoing support, etc., you would recommend AA?
Well, the only desire for attendance at AA is a desire to stop drinking. Mm. So the question is, have you got a desire to stop drinking? Mm. And you know what I'm going to say, Anna. They say, no, I just like to learn to moderate.
Right.
Because as humans, we are always looking for an easier, softer way. So Please feel free to go out and look for that easier, softer way. And you may find one, or you may not. And this is about consciousness. Are you conscious? You asked me earlier about what is making you pick up a drink? What are you thirsty for? Mm. So I think that nobody wants to go around with a label that says I'm an alcoholic. Nobody also wants to go around with a label saying you're a dumb blonde, but you may well be. You know, some people don't want to go around and be called a woman or a man or an old person or a young person. Oh, old lady. You know, we have the whole joke in France about the moment where you stop being called Mademoiselle and they start calling you Madame. Care? Is your ego really that fragile? Is your life really built on sand to that extent that a label like that will cause you any problems? Really? Ask yourself that question. What's the problem here? What would that look like if that were the case? It's so nuanced, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. And I'll end with that. An observation from recent press article that, you know, someone at the top of their A game, like Andrew Lloyd Webber, has recently, you know, come out and talked about his alcohol problems. And he talked about the fact that getting sober was literally the best thing he's ever done and his greatest achievement. And it struck me as I was reading that we're talking about a guy who's made hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds of some of the most popular blockbusting musicals and performances in the world, and had runs of kind of 25, 30 years on Broadway and in the West End. And he says that this is his greatest achievement. This is the thing that he wished he'd done earlier.
Isn't that wonderful?
Isn't it?
And I'm imagining that the second thing he'll probably say is his greatest achievement is actually taking that message to other people through service, because that really is the piece that makes us feel secure, significant and accepted, is serving others.
Yeah.
And of course, not when serving is your be all and end all to the expense of yourself. But that really is the beauty of being human.
And we're going to leave it there. Lindsay, thank you so, so much for your time today. I know you're a busy lady, so I'm very, very grateful that we've had this conversation and we've had it here on this show. So thank you. Where can people find you? Where can people get in touch? And where would you point them to if they wanted to find out a bit more about sophrology as well?
Absolutely. Well, I run a reasonably comprehensive website, which is lindsayfrancis.co.uk. I also run richsimplehuman.com. You can find me on my own podcast, of course, Rich Simple Human. And I do love to provide as much free advice as possible. I'm always available for a conversation with anybody. If people want to talk, then here I am. And I also love hanging out on LinkedIn. You may find a little bit on Instagram, but please do listen into the show. And the same goes for you, Anna. It's just a delight to share this time with you.
Oh, thank you so much. We'll put all of those links into the show notes. And I'll thank you again. Thank you so much, Lindsay. You take care. Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. It really helps other people find the show. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find all of my resources and become part of the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com.